Please stay tuned to the end of the episode to hear a trailer from one of our favorite podcasts, the incredibly written and expertly narrated Nowhere Dispatch. The Nowhere Dispatch features all sorts of eerie Texas tales and strange happenings, from true crime to unexplained events, to gunslingers and scarcely known history. I can't stress enough how good the Nowhere Dispatch is. You're not doing yourself any favors if you're not listening. Now on to the episode.
The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Grand Prairie, Texas is just to the east of Arlington, between Dallas and Fort Worth. Named Deckman in 1863, after Alexander McRae Deckman, half of the prairie acreage was traded to TMP Railroad in 1867, a move Deckman made to ensure that the company would build a railroad line through the town of his namesake. After the railroad was built, a U.S. post office was established in 1877, and roots were planted for the town's name change to come. The U.S. Postal Service, it seems, made a little mistake when naming their new facility. Instead of Deckman with an H, they officially named the office Deckman with a K, a mistake largely considered due to bad handwriting. Further confusion arose as TMP Railroad designated the name Grand Prairie to their lines that ran between Dallas and Fort Worth, a name given to the route as a result of maps that had called the area that, drawn up in the 1850s. Mail delivery and government business suffered as a result of all these inconsistencies in the name, and inevitably, the Postal Service changed the name of their office there to Grand Prairie. The town was eventually and officially incorporated as a city in 1909, called, of course, Grand Prairie. In the early 20th century, a Vought aircraft facility provided residents employment. Aircraft and defense manufacturers continued to drive much of the city's economy. Toward the end of the mid-20th century, Grand Prairie would become famous, at least to locals of Fort Worth, Dallas, and the surrounding cities and ever-growing suburban developments, for an establishment that would capture the imagination and demand the awe of children and adults alike. Originally located in Dallas's Fair Park, the Southwestern Historical Wax Museum opened in Grand Prairie in 1972. The history of the museum is rich, and truly begins at the end of the 19th century when a Clay County deputy sheriff and Henrietta Marshall, Henry Harrison Schwend, began collecting firearms. Because Oklahoma was Native American territory during a good portion of Schwend's career, and Clay County's northernmost border rides the Oklahoma line, he met countless outlaws who passed through his jurisdiction, seeking refuge where U.S. lawmen had little to no authority, at least on paper, and became well acquainted with the lawmen who tracked many of these infamous individuals as well. Schwend developed a reputation for this hobby and was given firearms to add to his collection, many owned by those infamous outlaws and legendary lawmen, from Texas Rangers to U.S. Marshals. The collection of firearms changed hands a few times after Henry Harrison Schwend died in 1924, almost ending up in the hands of the famous film star singing cowboy Roy Rogers at one point. Harrison's brother Burton first inherited the guns, then his wife when he died, who sold the collection to the owner of Brown Jewelry in Wichita Falls. Eventually, in 1957, a man named W. Thomas Bolton purchased the seemingly priceless weapons. Bolton had become somewhat obsessed with the idea of wax sculptures of famous people and scenes after visiting Madame Tussaud's wax museum in London, and he had an idea, a good idea, for an attraction back home. He was finally able to secure loans, and along with investors John A. Prather and J.C. Brown, Bolton bought Schwen's collection, opening the Southwestern Historical Wax Museum at State Fair Park in Dallas in 1963, where the attraction's wax figures would be centered around the famous firearms themselves. The main idea was to highlight the impressive and one-of-a-kind collection. The replicas of famous and infamous folks were sort of a gimmick to draw in the crowd. Guns that once belonged to Pancho Villa, Geronimo, Bell Starr, Wild Bill Hickok, Billy the Kid, Bat Masterson, Buffalo Bill Cody, and Sam Houston were just a few in the collection. It's said that actor Warren Beatty himself donated the Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow death car used in the feature film co-starring the great Faye Dunaway to the Southwestern Historical Wax Museum, since the bullet holes apparently had been filled in to shoot a pre-death scene. The museum had to find and hire someone to re-riddle the car with bullets. It was, no doubt, an excellent addition to the Bonnie and Clyde exhibit already at the attraction when they had replicas of Dunaway and Beatty as Parker and Barrow to go alongside the donated vehicle. The Wax Museum, of course, was a hit. The crowds became so large that Bolton, Prather, and Brown began making plans for a larger space shortly into the venture. They decided upon Grand Prairie as the new home of the Wax Museum of the Southwest, the new name given to the attraction when it opened its doors in 1972, since it was so close to Arlington, which housed amusement parks and where a brand new ballpark was set to open, home of the also brand new to the state baseball club, the Texas Rangers. By this time, the collection had grown to include other memorabilia too, including the dress worn by U.S. District Judge Sarah T. Hughes when she swore in Lyndon B. Johnson after John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas in 1963. There was a wax figure reenactment of that scene, as a matter of fact, as well as replicas of Jackie O and JFK. I remember going as a child in the 1980s, mesmerized and horrified by the barn of hanged outlaws and the eerie Wild Bill Hickok death scene, capturing the moment before he was shot in the back as he played poker in a Deadwood, South Dakota watering hole. I knew the story. Shortly after the Wax Museum of the Southwest's move to Grand Prairie in 1972, W. Thomas Bolton's daughters, Sally Horning and Patricia Bolton Wright, became co-owners of the establishment, which by then was worth a couple million dollars. Sally was going to Texas Tech for business courses and was knowledgeable of how to handle that end of the Wax Museum of the Southwest, keeping up with the books and applying her first-hand experience of the day-to-day operations there. Patricia, better known as Patsy, came on in 1973. She was a natural business person whose skills at public relations are said to have taken the attraction to new heights. W. Thomas Bolton died in 1976, and although a brutal battle for the inheritance was waged between the sisters and their stepmother, when all was said and done, Sally and Patricia were able to maintain control of their father's business. Patsy, at this point, already knew how to work the Dallas socialite scene. After all, she'd grown up in it. She was raised in Park Cities, a suburban enclave of Dallas, and home to many individuals who can boast the highest incomes in the city, as well as the entire state. The Wax Museum and collecting historical Texas artifacts were only Patsy's father's passions. What made him his fortune was oil. But regardless of the family's means, Patsy and her sister attended public school at Hillcrest High, which, to be perfectly clear, isn't much of a step down from private school considering the condition of the Texas public school system. She was born into wealth and elevated social status, not only because her father was an oil man, but also because her great uncle on her mother's side was a Texas legend, House Speaker Sam Rayburn. By the time Patsy was ready to make her own way, though, she was a force to be reckoned with in her own right. She was considered highly intelligent and always welcoming, hospitable, and amicable. Her laugh described as one of the most memorable aspects of her. She was sophisticated, but Patsy was not a delicate flower. Training and spending time with horses was where her real passion lied, preferring the boots and blue jeans lifestyle to the stiff and often fake world of business hobnobbing and social club schmoozing, though she was comfortable in both worlds. In January of 1965, after finishing college, Patsy Bolton married classmate Bill Wright, and the couple moved into a large colonial-style house in Arlington. Described as a workaholic, Bill had little time for anything other than his job as an executive for a large department store chain, and the couple's relationship fizzled out. Patsy and Bill divorced in October of 1980. By all indications, the split was mutual and amicable. The divorced couple split their possessions. Bill kept a 1980 Cadillac Eldorado, a boat, some furnishings, and the possessions he'd accumulated or come into the marriage with, and Patsy kept a 78 pickup truck and the furnishings and items she'd inherited from her father. Of course, Patsy kept the 3 saddle horses they owned. She and her sister Sally continued to run the Wax Museum of the Southwest, furthering their father's passion, which also happened to be quite lucrative. The next several years of Patsy's life weren't without successes, trials, and tribulations, to be sure, but the year 1987 changed everything. Building upon the success of the Wax Museum of the Southwest, Patsy and Sally opened the Plaza Theater of Wax in San Antonio, just across from the Alamo, the site of a monumental event in the Texas Revolution against Mexico that Texans insist not be forgotten. The opening was a hit. Patsy's income was substantial at this point, and she expected the following year to be even more rewarding. At 43 years old, salary and assets considered, Patsy was a millionaire. A few months after the opening of the new Wax Museum in San Antonio, Patsy would satisfy her other side by winning a cutting horse contest at the Mesquite Rodeo. To put simply, the competition is designed to display a horse's athletic and natural ability to maintain control of a cow who has lost its way from the herd and guide it back. The competition requires the horse's rider to display a great deal of athleticism too, as well as ample courage. She was thrilled with the win, and she'd spend the morning of Thursday, October 22, 1987, attempting to train a powerful and stubborn horse named Dry Leo, who she'd bought the previous year for use in cutting competitions. Patsy headed back to Arlington from Hyco, where experienced horse trainer Bill Anderson had been guiding her efforts to soothe Dry Leo's seemingly impenetrable spirit. The drive to her rented home was about 2 hours. She'd recently sold her house in preparation to move into a 30-acre ranch in Aledo. The sale was still pending, and she was anxious to take a leap into rural life where she could spend much of her time with her horses, one of which she'd just made a down payment on that morning. Patsy's close friends weren't crazy about her move to the country. They were worried about her living alone in that environment. The previous Monday, in fact, one of those friends, who lived in Highland Park in Dallas, called her in a panic. She'd woken up from a dream that Patsy was slain by 2 men. Patsy laughed it off. She hadn't even moved out to the country yet. And anyway, she'd just purchased a nice Glock pistol for protection. She wasn't worried at all. On the contrary, she was excited and impatient for the move. Upon arriving in Arlington, Patsy made her way to Grand Prairie, to the Wax Museum, where a cocktail party was happening to kick off the year's Halloween tours. The Halloween season, obviously, was one of the attraction's most popular times of year. The museum came alive as a sort of haunted house, mixing costumed actors in with the wax figures of Dracula and Frankenstein, among other horror icons, for extra fright factor. The cocktail party was also a full dress rehearsal for the event, and it went off without a hitch. Patsy left the celebration a little early. She was tired from the eventful day and all the traveling, and she joined some friends at a hotel lounge not too far from the museum for a beer. When she got back home at around 9 p.m., she made some calls, most notably to her son, Wayne, before slipping into her pajamas, fixing some scrambled eggs, chasing them with about a half a beer, and calling it a night. She set her alarm for the following morning and slid beneath the sheets that laid atop her king-sized waterbed. She was exhausted, but her mind was racing with thoughts of her new Alito ranch, her horses, and the upcoming Halloween season at the Wax Museum. Patsy often drank a capful of NyQuil before she went to bed to help jumpstart sleep a little, and did so this night as well. This time, though, something was wrong. Just before 3 a.m., now Friday, October 23, 1987, the phone rang at the home of Patsy's sister, Sally. Her brother-in-law, Steve Horning, answered the call. It was Patsy, and she asked for Sally. Sally barely made out what her sister was saying. Her voice was faint, almost a whisper. "I've taken some NyQuil, and something's really, really wrong. I'm having trouble breathing," Patsy told her. Sally hung up and immediately called police. She didn't know Patsy's rent house address, though, so an ambulance could not be sent. Sally and Steve raced to their vehicle, backing into a parked car as they hurriedly sped to Patsy's house, which was only a few miles away. They screeched to a halt in front of Patsy's rented home, and upon frantically trying to get in the locked front door, to which Sally had no key, she remembered Patsy had told her that the spare key she'd kept hidden in case she got locked out had mysteriously disappeared recently. Steve bolted to Patsy's bedroom window. It was cracked, and he slid through. He looked at Patsy. She appeared to have passed out, so he raced to the front door to let Sally in. A burglar alarm was put in not long before, after several windows in the home had been broken, but no valuables stolen. Upon opening the front door for Sally, it was apparent to the couple that the burglar alarm had not been activated that night. Steve and Sally hurried to Patsy's room, saw that her eyes were open, but unable to follow movement. Her eyes were unseeing. They couldn't get her up, and their attempts at eliciting a response failed, so they called 911. When paramedics arrived, along with firemen, they quickly realized there was nothing they could do. Patsy's pupils were beginning to dilate. She had no blood pressure. No pulse. Paramedics wasted no time, however, loading Patsy on a gurney and into the ambulance, rushing to Arlington Memorial Hospital. Patsy was declared dead there at 4:15 a.m. by Dr. Tim Williams. Patsy's family was in shock, and medical staff at Arlington Memorial were confused as to what happened to her. Signs of foul play weren't obvious, and an autopsy, performed by the Tarrant County Medical Examiner's Office, provided no further insight on how Patsy died. Her death, at the time, could only be attributed to natural causes. In a statement to police, Patsy's brother-in-law, Steve Horning, said he removed a tray with two plates from Patsy's bed so that he could administer CPR. He told them that he performed mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, which prompted green fluid to come up, and that he'd spit out the green fluid on the bed or a towel and continue. It's said that no one suspected foul play at first, but the actions of a forward-thinking patrolman, Patrick Bridges, might suggest otherwise. Before leaving the scene, the officer noticed a bottle of NyQuil in Patsy's bathroom, picked it up, and placed it in an evidence bag. And on the following Monday, October 26th, Arlington Police Department Sergeant J. Gustafson, or Sergeant Gus, sat unsuspecting as his commanding officer approached, dramatically smacking a folder on the desk in front of him. "Gus, something's not right here," he said. Sergeant Gus didn't have to scrutinize the entirety of the file to agree with his boss. A little over a page in, the 8-year seasoned homicide detective's intuition kicked in. Patsy's death made no sense, and it wasn't just a gut feeling. She was extremely healthy and didn't use drugs. There wasn't a suicide note. The medical staff at Arlington Memorial, nor the medical examiner, could explain how or why Patsy died. These irregularities were only the beginning of what Sergeant Gus's investigation would uncover. Patsy's daughter Leslie was shocked by her mother's sudden death. According to Leslie, the day after Patsy died, she was at her mother's home in a state of bewilderment and, of course, grief when the phone rang. She picked up the phone and solemnly greeted the caller. A woman's voice asked to speak with Patsy, to which Leslie replied, "She's not here. Can I take a message?" The woman on the other line wouldn't let up. She was adamant that Leslie allow her to speak with her mother. Finally, Leslie explained to the caller that Patsy passed away the previous day. "Well, good," Leslie described the caller as saying. "I wanted her dead." 8 days after Patsy was found unresponsive by her sister and brother-in-law and was pronounced dead at Arlington Memorial Hospital shortly thereafter, Sergeant Gus received a call from Dr. Mark Krause, Tarrant County Deputy Medical Examiner. Blood and tissue samples taken from Patsy's body had been sent to a lab to be ran through a gas chromatographic mass spectrometer, a machine that can determine the presence of over 4,000 chemical compounds, a far greater number than tests performed by the medical examiner's office could detect. Upon screening Patsy's blood sample, the machine's readout spiked hard. Dr. Krause, alluding that he had big news about the results, asked Sergeant Gus if he were sitting down. The doctor told the homicide detective that when asked to identify the chemical compound that caused the machine to spike so dramatically, the response was strychnine. Sergeant Gus's mind immediately went to the 6-ounce bottle of NyQuil that he read in the report was bagged at the scene, in an outstanding moment of police intuition by patrolman Patrick Bridges. Sergeant Gus retrieved the bottle from evidence, sent it out to have the remaining contents tested. The results came and affirmed his hunch. The bottle of NyQuil contained the chemical. The Angry Lover's Poison is a nickname for strychnine because the death brought on by the chemical is excruciating, and if the killer chooses it as his weapon, the intent is to make the victim suffer. Murder of humans, of course, isn't strychnine's intended use. The substance is meant to kill pests, most often rodents. When ingested, the compound produces symptoms and reactions that are indescribably painful and not at all what could be considered anything but slow if a fatal dose is taken. According to toxicologists and the Poison Control Center, within 15 minutes, someone who has ingested strychnine will undergo muscle twitching, sudden massive convulsions, and a feeling of suffocation. Head and feet stiffen. The body arcs backward in tetanic spasms. The victim's facial muscles cause the mouth to contract into a fixed grin, and then a short period of relaxation for the body, but dread for the mind as the victim awaits the next repeated onset of the convulsions, usually 3 or 4, before paralysis of the respiratory system ultimately causes death. The form of strychnine available to mass consumers who seek to rid themselves of unwanted varmints contains only 3% of the actual chemical. Strychnine in its purest form is unavailable to the public legally and sold only to authorized buyers. It's not easy to get in its pure, full-strength form. Only about 100 companies in the United States are authorized to use or sell strychnine, according to a spokesman for the Environmental Protection Agency. The strychnine found in Patsy's NyQuil bottle was the substance in its purest form. A meeting was immediately called to make sense of the newfound discovery. Tarrant County Deputy Medical Examiner Dr. Mark Krause, Chief Medical Examiner Dr. Nizam Pirwani, FBI investigators, Dallas Police Department intelligence officials, representatives from the Environmental Protection Agency, and representatives from the company that manufactures NyQuil, Vicks Corporation, joined Sergeant Gus to discuss the case the day after the strychnine was detected. Product tampering was ruled out. No other instances of strychnine poisoning had been reported. It was an isolated incident, an attack, clearly, against a single person, Patsy. The case belonged solely to Sergeant Gus and the Arlington Police Department. As he continued to investigate this newly found lead, it became even more apparent to Sergeant Gus that Patsy was the sole target. He found out from a close friend of the victim that Patsy had a fondness for the liquid cold and flu medicine, a habit that originated when Patsy became a mother and discovered that NyQuil, in small doses, soothed her baby's teething discomfort. "I used to tease her about being a NyQuil head," her friend disclosed, noting that Patsy used the medication as a sort of cure-all. The habit was well known to those who knew her. Upon testing of the remaining NyQuil in the bottle confiscated from the scene of Patsy's death, it was determined that the amount of strychnine mixed into the liquid was just to the point of saturation, meaning that it was the maximum amount that could have been added and mixed without detection. If any more were added, the chemical would have settled to the bottom and been clearly visible. Only a chemist, someone with an astute understanding of chemistry, or someone who was bright enough to figure out what the correct amount to add to avoid detection, police asserted, could have been responsible for poisoning Patsy. Patsy's cause of death was officially listed as undetermined. The medical examiner was unable to say for a fact that she died as the result of suicide or homicide. One thing was perfectly clear to Patsy's friends and family. She didn't commit suicide. She'd just purchased her dream home on a ranch. She was gaining recognition for her work with cutting horses. The Wax Museum of the Southwest was wildly successful. Friend and general manager of the Wax Museum, Bill Phillips, said, "Patsy would never take her own life. She loved life. She was outgoing, happy, independent. She could knock you off your feet with enthusiasm." Patsy's son, Wayne, and sister, Sally, echoed this sentiment, as did every other family member and friend. The medical examiner brought in psychologist Dr. Joanne Houts to render a psychological autopsy of the victim to see if she could provide any evidence at all that Patsy might have taken her own life. It was Dr. Houts' opinion that Patsy fell into the category of low risk for suicide, noting that she was a strong, independent person who was actively planning for her future, whose health was considered excellent, and whose financial situation was far from strained. Sergeant Gus and his colleagues in the Arlington Police Department agreed. Strychnine was rare in suicides due to the excruciating pain that comes before death, and nothing on the scene suggested suicide anyway. The house was locked, lights on, television on, and perhaps the most telling detail, since someone who intended to commit suicide wouldn't have planned for the day after, the alarm clock was set, and even went off that morning. Besides, Patsy had recently purchased a Glock pistol, which would have rendered suicide quick and painless, most likely. It was abundantly clear to Sergeant Gus that someone wanted Patsy Wright dead, and in their determination to do so, had placed enough strychnine in her bottle of NyQuil to kill up to 9 people. What the homicide detective lacked was motive. He wanted to know who stood to gain what if Patsy died. Or was it simpler? Retaliation for a slight she'd made, or was perceived to have made? Patsy was in a good place when she died on the surface, but what laid beneath? As his investigation continued, Sergeant Gus found plenty. Failed and strained relationships with lovers, unconventional family dynamic, and dark secrets. The strange events that surrounded Patsy's death and the discovery that she'd been poisoned were only the beginning. A list of potential suspects, alarming evidence, disappearing documents, and bizarre, potentially connected deaths shocked investigators as they attempted to unravel the mystery behind Patsy Wright's death. That's next time on Gone Cold. If you have any information about the murder of Patricia Bolton Wright, please contact the Arlington Police Department Cold Cases at 817-459-5772 or Tarrant County Crime Stoppers 817-469-8477. You can remain completely anonymous there. Don't forget to stick around to the end to hear a trailer for the amazing podcast, The Nowhere Dispatch. Also, if you're a big Unsolved Mysteries fan, be sure to check out the Trail Went Cold's episode about Patsy Wright and the Wax Museum. The Dallas Morning News, the Austin American Statesman, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and the television show Unsolved Mysteries were used as sources for this episode. If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. There are several varying donation levels to choose from, with perks to go along with each, including ad-free listening at all levels. Donations help us cover the costs of research and production, and we can't thank y'all enough for your support. Another great way to support the show is to leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you listen to the show. It helps guide more folks our way. And if you're interested in a spot on the web to read true crime cases, look no further than thetruecrimefiles.com. There you'll find well-presented cases, many unknown or ignored by the media, as well as book reviews, podcast reviews, and guest spots. Thetruecrimefiles.com is one of our favorite resources for learning about cases. Check it out. Thanks for listening, y'all.
When you stare into the woods in the stillest part of the night, what stares back at you? When your car tires kick up dust on a lonely red dirt road, what will you find waiting for you at the end? What if you had the chance to explore the legends you heard growing up, the half-remembered stories told around a campfire, and the rumors which can't possibly be true? My name is Lucas. Here on the Nowhere Dispatch podcast, follow me into the middle of the deepest, darkest reaches of the place I call home, East Texas. It's filled with history, heresy, blood, riches, and mysteries long unsolved. Among the pines, things can get very weird. Follow me on Twitter at Nowhere Dispatch for updates and links to new episodes. Come with me, dear listener, and I'll guide you straight into the middle of nowhere.